Hello everyone and welcome to Sportspiel, a fortnightly podcast bringing you in-depth sports discussion and insightful feature interviews. We are currently sitting outside Tower Bridge of all places. It was sunny today, but the clouds are starting to come out and play. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, is someone with a quite glorious beard, but he does know his thing about sport. It's Mr. Will Moulton.
Hello. Thanks very much for that introduction. I wouldn't say glorious beard, but there we go. But yeah, it's nice to be here. The sun is just starting to peek out as we speak, actually. Very excited to be part of this exciting podcast. And yeah, can't wait to get cracking. Apologies also for that jingle music. That's going to be in your head for the rest of the day. It's already in mine. So good luck.
You will never find a better piece of music. And don't do yourself a disservice. It is a glorious beard. Since it's the first episode, we'll briefly go through how it is structured. In our first segment, myself and Will are going to go through some of the sporting stories that have caught our eye in the last couple of weeks. In this episode, we're going to talk about the British and Irish Lions squad, which was announced yesterday. We'll also then talk about the PFA Awards. The awards night is this Sunday, the 23rd of April. And the Team of the Year was announced today. We'll also go through what's going on in F1 at the moment. And to finish off, we'll talk about MP wannabe James Cracknell. So if anyone needs a quick Google search, look for his Sky News interview. It was quite something. In our second segment, it's our feature interview section where we are going to go in depth with someone from the sporting world. In this episode, I spoke to Team GB Olympic fencer James Andrew Davis about his career, his life, competing at the Olympics, becoming Britain's first ever European champion, and also UK Sports funding cut for the Fencing Olympic programme. All that and more on Sportspiel. Anyway, chitter-chatter aside, let's dive into the first segment, our sporting discussion section. And the first topic is the British and Irish Lions squad, which was announced yesterday by Warren Gatland. 41 players. I'm not going to go through them all because we don't have enough time for that. But we're going to go, and it's very boring, but we're going to go through the main talking points. And the first of which is Joe Launchbury at lock not being selected despite two man of the match performances during the Six Nations for England. What did you make of that?
I mean, I'm incredibly biased because I'm a Wasps fan myself, but to see Launchbury in there was quite... We knew about it a couple of days before. We knew he wasn't going to be selected. But I just personally don't get it. He was, as you said, put two man of the match performances in for England. I think he was unlucky not to have had a third as well. He's been in superb form over the last sort of year. And I know George Cruise is probably first choice for England, but he should be first choice alongside Launchbury. And I would personally wouldn't have Courtney Laws in. He's a key pivotal part to a Wasp side that are taking the Viva Premiership by storm. But it's Gatland's decision at the end of the day. It's not mine. So he's gone for it. And he's got a squad of 41 incredibly exciting players there. Like, there's never been, I don't think, a better chance in the modern era for the Lions to beat New Zealand.
To be the general consensus is that the squad that he's got is just full of strength throughout all the ranks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the back rows here, actually, just in front of me. You've got Talupi Faletau, Sean O'Brien, Peter Omahony, CJ Stander, like some of the people, it's absolute brutes in there. Billy Vunipola as well. And that's just in the back rows, so it's really, really exciting. It's going to be a brutal contest.
And another talking point that came out yesterday, Sam Warburton being named captain. It's the second man to captain two Lions tours after Martin Johnson, of course. Right call for you?
Yeah. Don't change your winning formula. Warburton was captain down under last time in Australia. He hasn't been captain of Wales. He relynquished that role to Alan Wynne-Jones, but considering he hasn't even gone for Dylan Hartley in the squad, which is something we'll talk about in a minute, there wasn't really any other choice. Rory Best, maybe, but he's not really ever captained Ireland, has he? So I don't see why he would be captain for this. I remember Greg Laidlaw as well was touted as a potential captain. He also hasn't been selected, so going for someone he knows, someone he can trust. When Gatland was in charge, well, Gatland still is in charge of Wales, but he's had Warburton as his Welsh captain as well. It just makes sense, and Warburton's a fantastic player. Yeah, he's injured at the moment. There's a few question marks over his fitness, but he'll be back. He'll be on top form, and he's the right man to take this group of players into New Zealand.
And we've talked about a couple of points just there, but we'll look at Dylan Hartley, the England captain, missing out. I suppose it wasn't really a surprise, considering he seemed to be subbed around the 50-minute mark in all the games of the Six Nations. It's not really a surprise that he's missed out, is it?
No, and Jamie George has been selected. George won't start any of the three tests, I don't think. He's more of an impact player, but he's a very, very talented young man, and he was making the difference. When he came on in those sort of last 30 minutes of all the Six Nation games, he was making the difference. His line-out ability, actually throwing the ball, is really good. He's a powerful runner. He's a great tackler. He's very switched on. So I can understand that. And Hartley was never going to get picked over Rory Best. And, yeah, question marks remain. A lot of people were criticising Hartley. I think, you know, he's doing a job for England. He's in there. He's captaining the side really well. He's got hold of his discipline, at least on an international level. He's done great things with the England side. So I think the criticism aimed towards him has been a bit harsh. I can see where it's come from, but, I'm not surprised he wasn't selected. And I don't know about you. Were you surprised at all?
No, not really. I mean, considering the position he plays in, it's quite a strong competition, really, for him. So they've got, I think, 6 weeks before they fly off to New Zealand. And, of course, a lot can change in that time. Rugby's obviously a very physical game, and injuries are bound to happen. So I'm sure some surprising call-ups will happen along the line.
Yeah, we saw it last time. Christian Wade, who hasn't even been selected in the England squad to tour Argentina this summer, which, again, as a Wasps fan, I find a bit of a joke because he's an absolute class player. He was called up to the halfway through last time, and that was a complete left field out of nowhere. So it'll be interesting to see who does get called up when injuries occur.
Absolutely, absolutely. So moving away from rugby and the Lions, and we're talking about PFA awards, that time of year in the football season where we award those who've had a particularly outstanding campaign. The PFA team was announced today, and I'll just quickly run through it. Manchester United's David De Gea in goal. Kyle Walker, right back. Gary Cahill, David Luiz, centre back. Danny Rose at left back. And Sadio Mane, right midfield.
Sadio Mane, left midfield.
Right, fair enough, left midfield.
Hazard on the right.
Dele Alli and N'Golo Kante in the middle, and then up top is Harry Kane and Romelu Lukaku. Now, we've had a fair discussion about this, how we change it. It's fair to say we disagree on a few of those.
No, you just disagree on my choices.
It's because your choices are terrible. Personally, I'm taking out David De Gea and putting Hugo Lloris in. I think he's been fantastic for Spurs this season, and it's also the best defence in the league. So I think you've got to also have Toby Alderweireld in instead of Gary Cahill. He's a phenomenal defender, best in the league for me. And I also have Marcus Alonso in at left back. He's contributed attacking wise for Chelsea, and his absence against Manchester United on the weekend definitely showed. Now on to your picks and the changes you'd make. Bear in mind, everyone, some of them are very left field.
I mean, you could tell I'm not necessarily that big a sports fan. I mean, I am, but a football fan even. But yeah, I've actually changed formation. So the PFA came out with a 4-4-2. I've gone for a 3-4-3. Like you, I would change the goalkeeper, but I'd actually put Tom Heaton in goal of Burnley.
No, I'm not having that.
If you look at it though, he's had a fantastic season. He's made more saves than anyone else in the Premier League. Single-handedly stopped Burnley from, you know, being relegated, because their away form has been pitiful, but they've done fairly well at home. He's been an absolute rock. Then in defence, I would agree with you. I'd bring in Alderweireld and Alonso. Obviously, Alonso in a back three, he's not actually been tried and tested yet, but you know what, go for it. And my other centre-back would be... I've gone for a bit of sort of a Burnley love in here. I've gone for Michael Keane, which you don't agree with, Alistair.
No, I mean, yes, he's a good player. Yes, he's had a good season for Burnley, but not Team of the Year standards. He's candidate for Player of the Year for Burnley. And yes, he got his England call-up, but quite frankly, if I was to have a run of five games in the Premier League at the moment, my footballing ability means that won't happen. But I'm definitely in a running for a shot at the England senior team, considering
he's
the current state.
Bad. He's a good player.
He's a good player, but not Team of the Year standard.
Anyway, we'll move on. I actually selected the exact same midfield and two strikers, but with my third striker would be Zlatan, just for what he's done at Man U this season. It was quite a tough choice. There's been some good strikers this year, but Zlatan scored, 27 goals in all competitions? Man United are sixth in the table. Without him, I don't know where they'd be, because they've struggled for goals all year. And also, I do love Zlatan. I think he's brilliant. Just great advert for the Premier League to have him here.
That I will grudgingly admit, is that he is a very compelling character to have around in the league. But now moving on to the actual awards themselves, which aren't being announced until Sunday night. Candidates for Player of the Year is Eden Hazard, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Harry Kane, N'Golo Kante, Romelu Lukaku, and Arsenal's Alexis Sanchez. Who are we picking out of that group to win Player of the Year?
I went for Kane. When I was actually going for my Team of the Year, I've looked at players who've been around and performed consistently over the whole season. And with Kane, you could say, yeah, he's missed spells. But actually, when he's been in the squad, he's been on fire. He's been irresistible. And I know Kante and Lukaku and Zlatan and Hazard have all played really well consistently this season as well. But Kane's just that level above for me at the moment.
Again, while I respect your opinion, I will knock it sideways and say it's total rubbish. For me, it's got to be N'Golo Kante. 2 years running, he is effectively charged aside to the championship. Granted, Chelsea haven't won it yet, but they will. And I think that side of the game, that defensive side of the game, is so often overlooked in favour of attacking play. The guy is a machine. There's something very robotic about him. What he does should not be done by a human being. He just chases around the pitch. Of his height, and he's also such a humble character, and I think a lot of people love him for that. Now, going on to the young player of the year, Dele Alli is up for it. Harry Kane, Michael Keane, Romelu Lukaku, Sunderland, Jordan Pickford, and Leroy Sané of Manchester City. Your pick out of that?
I'm excited to go for Michael Keane, but to be honest, I'm surprised this individual wasn't in the player of the year, but Dele Alli. Especially in the last 15 games, I think he scored 16 goals, a few assists in there. Again, just another level above. Obviously not above Kane, but I've already picked Kane. I don't want to pick him again, so Dele Alli for me all day long. And I think you agree, don't you?
On this occasion, I do agree. Dele Alli has had a phenomenal season. He's such a good player to watch. Although I will give a shout-out to Jordan Pickford at Sunderland, because in a team that is, frankly, dire, he's put in some very impressive performances, and he's definitely got a bright future. Of course, it's not all about the men at the PFA awards. We've also got the Women's Player of the Year awards. Up for that is Ellen White, Lucy Bronze, Karen Carney, Jane Ross, Jill Scott, and Caroline Weir. I think we've picked the same person to win that as well. For me, she's world class, and it's got to be Lucy Bronze, a right back. There is no one that really matches her in that position in the world, and she's so important to what Manchester City do.
Yeah, I remember I was at a Sunderland ladies game 2 seasons ago now, during 2015. It was actually a Continental Tires Cup game, but Lucy Bronze was playing, and I was standing. What I love about Sunderland is they play at the Hetton Centre, and you basically stand, and then there's a rail, and then there's the pitch, and it's wonderful. And I was standing just next to Lucy Bronze, and she was just incredible. Her crossing ability as well, her tackling ability. She links up with Jill Scott beautifully down the right. She's just brilliant, and she seems. I don't think either of us have ever interviewed her, but she seems just like a really, really nice person as well. Her mum retweeted something I wrote about Lucy Bronze as well, which always makes me feel good about myself. So,
if your middle name is Tough, which wasn't a joke, it is actually her middle name.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. Little fun fact there. You've got to be good if you can have a middle name like that.
Yeah.
Now onto the young player. Up for that is Millie Bright, Jess Carter, Nikita Paris, Georgia Stanway, Kira Walsh, and Caroline Weir again. I've gone for Caroline Weir for this, partly because she was also player of the year contention. But the Scottish international, she was Liverpool's top scorer last season, with 7 goals from midfield as well, for a 21-year-old. That's a very impressive record, and I can't really look beyond that.
I went for Georgia Stanway. If you look at her stats, nothing outrageous, outstanding, but she's turning 18 this year. She's just an absolute star in the making. She really is. She hasn't been selected for the Euro squad. She would have been a very sort of left field choice if she had been, but she's a very, very classy player. Her touch is impeccable. And she's really come on leaps and bounds this year in the City squad, and I'm excited for her future.
Now, away from the football, we're going to drive right on, pun intended, to F1.
Oh dear.
Ferrari are back in the game, which is quite really exciting to see, but we're going to talk about who we think has been the driver of the year so far. Granted, we're only 3 races in, but we do need something to talk about. So, who's your driver of the year so far?
So, the obvious one, from an outside perspective, is Vettel. You're back on form. He's put Mercedes under pressure, but he and Hamilton are performing the best in the best two engines and with the best two cars. But if you look further down the grid, for me, it's actually, he's only scored 3 points so far this season, but he's finished 10th every race. He's in a bright pink car as well, so you can't miss him. But Esteban Ocon, he came in halfway through last season. No one really knew who he was, even sort of the big experts, the journalistic experts in motorsport. Esteban Ocon didn't really know a lot about him, and he came in up against sort of the golden boy Pascal Wehrlein, and he outperformed him in those last 10 races of the season. And this season he's gone in, he got that drive at Force India which he deserved, he's gone straight into the side, and that Force India car is an absolute dog. It's terrible, it's got no speed, and what him and Sergio Perez are doing with it is just unbelievable. And he's driven superbly, there's not really been any crashes or any incidents like that. He's on top form, and yeah, he's really shone for me.
Speaking of cars that are dogs, one of the comedy highlights of the Bahrain Grand Prix for me was Alonso's rant down the radio when he was driving his McLaren. I believe he said something along the lines of, "My God, I've never driven anything with so little power in my life." McLaren's situation just gets worse and worse, really.
It's sad. You can tell Alonso's not happy, and that's why he's being allowed to the Indy 500. That's sort of the big news just before the Bahrain Grand Prix was that he was going to miss Monaco, and Jenson Button was going to come back, and he was going to go and do an Indy. And that's basically McLaren trying to keep him happy, because he's not happy, and to be honest, rightly so. McLaren, the actual chassis McLaren have built is not a bad chassis. I wouldn't say it's Ferrari, Red Bull, Mercedes level, but it's not a bad chassis, but just that engine. You thought Honda by now would have sorted their issues out, but they've gone backwards this year, and it's so sad to watch. What was a great team, what, 6-7 years ago at the back of the field? Yeah, and
it's just falling apart.
Fernando Alonso for me is still the best driver on the grid, and what he's doing with that car is fantastic, but it's painful. It's really painful.
Yeah, it's definitely me regretting that decision to leave Ferrari, what, 2 years ago now, 1 year ago now. But now we're going to go on to F4 and the crash that everyone was talking about last week involving 17-year-old British driver Billy Munger at Donington. Now, he's lost both his legs as a result of the crash, and the video is really something. I mean, it's an onboard camera, and when you're watching it, you cannot see the car that he ploughs into the back of come in at all. If you're watching the video, it shocks you. Yeah. So I suppose it's not really a surprise that he's had such severe injuries, but there's been a lot of support rallying around him, particularly from the racing world. And I think how much have they raised now?
So the target, it was announced yesterday that Munger is fortunate. I think the first thing is that it's incredible that he's alive. That crash was horrific, and he's still critically ill in hospital, but the statement says he's in a stable condition, so he's alive, and that's the main thing that we should be focusing on. Yes, he's lost both his lower legs, but and it's horrible for him. You know, he won't be able to race in the same way again. But the fact he's alive is just... I'm so grateful to hear that. And our thoughts are with his friends and his family and everyone associated with him. But yesterday, their statement came out announcing sort of how he was doing. And also a Just Giving page has been set up to raise some money to sort of just get him through, to help him sort of put his life back on track and help him do whatever he wants to do in the future. So I think the target initially was £268,000. So it was set up by his parents, his team that he drives with, and also Tom Ingram, who's a British touring car racer. He's been a pivotal part, and already today, so it's less than 24 hours pretty much since the page was set up, they've already raised in excess of £400,000, which is amazing. I was flicking through the website earlier. You've got donations coming in from Portugal, from Australia, from Germany, from the Netherlands. You had Jenson Button donating £15,000. Former British Formula One driver Max Chilton's donated. Felipe Massa said he's going to donate. You've got all these major sporting stars, not from just British sport, but NASCAR, IndyCar. You've got Australian drivers from doing their series back here in Australia. Everyone's rallying around, and it's so nice to actually see the motorsport world come together. And as we said, all we want is for Billy to get well, to hopefully if find a way of getting back into a car if that's what he wants to do, and just enjoy and lead a normal life. So all our thoughts and best wishes go to him and his family.
Exactly. I mean, we wish him all the best in his recovery. But now going on to our final topic of discussion, and that is James Cracknell, of course, the Olympic rower. Now, the double gold medalist was campaigning to be an MP in 2020, but certain political events have changed that somewhat. But before, you know, Theresa May's announcement was made, he was campaigning on sort of to reduce obesity, really. I mean, as a sportsman himself, I know it's probably close to his heart.
It's not a bad not a bad general policy to have, to try and reduce that, I don't think. But I don't know, necessarily agree with the way he went about it.
No, that's the thing. Now, James Cracknell's previously sought election before. I didn't know this, but for the Conservatives, he tried to get a Westminster seat, failed. And he also tried to seek election for the European Parliament and failed. Now, his Sky News interview on Tuesday morning, he said this, quote, "If you think of the two countries of the world that have got a handle on obesity, what do you think they are?" And he asked that to the presenters. They obviously had no idea. Thankfully, he was there to enlighten us all. He said, "North Korea and Cuba. See, they are quite controlling on behavioural change."
Because they startled North Korea, starved their own people.
See, that was what was put to him by Jonathan Samuel at Sky. As a malnutrition does tend to help in lowering obesity rates. Unsurprisingly, he's come in for a fair amount of criticism for this. But what did you make of it all?
It's another example of someone who's clearly not done their homework, or clearly thought they found something, but James Cracknell really just should have. Like I said earlier, I don't necessarily disagree with what he's trying to say in terms of reducing obesity is a good thing, but he clearly, whoever thought that was a good idea to say that.
I think there's a big old PR rethink is needed. But that concludes the first segment of Sports Bill. But stick around, because after the break we'll have our feature interview with James Andrew Davis, and it's one you want to stick around for, because he's such an engaging person to listen to, and it really is a very interesting interview. See you later. Hello everyone, and welcome to our first feature interview. I'm delighted to say that joining me via Skype all the way from San Francisco is British fencer, Team GB Olympian, and the 2014 European foil champion, James Andrew Davis. James, how are you doing?
Morning. Pretty good, thank you. Nice sunny weather out here.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us. Now, for those who aren't familiar with fencing or James, I'll just briefly sum up. James was born and raised in Barnet in North London. He began fencing at the age of four, and is currently ranked 19th in the world. That's in men's foil. Represented Team GB in London 2012 and Rio 2016, and of course became Britain's first European champion in 2014 in Strasbourg. Now, let's go right back to the start, to a four-year-old James. Living in Barnet, how did you first get into fencing, and why was that the sport for you?
I think my brother takes a lot of the credit for this. He was at a Saturday club doing gymnastics there, and when they finished, the fencing would start. They'd come in, so basically while he was getting, you know, ready to leave, I got to see the fencing, and it was something, you know, sword fighting was just one of those things I absolutely loved. I think, again, he'd put Conan the Barbarian on. He's 4 years older than me, so he got in a little bit of trouble for that, but, you know, as a young boy, I was watching all these sword fighting films, you know, things like Star Wars and stuff. It just sort of, it just caught me, you know, caught my eye. And that was, as a boy growing up, those were the things I wanted to do. I just wanted to be a ninja or a knight, whatever it was. That's what I wanted to be. So this was the closest I'd ever seen, and I fell in love with it.
Well, that's a good enough a reason as any, really.
Yeah.
Now, you've been very vocal in the past. So past interviews, say, on the BBC about your weight growing up and in your teenage years. And I believe you weighed, what, more than 20 stone at one point. So looking away from a sporting side of things for a moment, how did that affect you growing up, and did it sort of play on your mind?
Yes and no. 90% of it was all muscle, so it was all right.
That's all right, yeah.
No, I'm 6'4", so I've always been taller than most kids growing up, you know. So there's definitely, as you're growing up, there's that state where a lot of it's puppy fat. For me, there was, you know, still carrying excess pounds on top of that. But I was sporty, so, you know, I was playing basketball, I was fencing all the time, so it wasn't a hindrance. I wasn't struggling to do things or play with my friends and stuff like that. So I was always an active kid, but, you know, I loved my food, and that's how I continued throughout my schooling, throughout secondary school as well. And then, of course, took a fair bit of a break when I hit sixth form, when I was doing my exams, and that I think is where I really gained most of the weight in, you know, 6 months or so. And then we really started, you know, my coach Shemak at the time, we were, he felt I could go on, I could be successful in this sport, but, you know, the one big change had to be the weight loss. And so he was quite supportive. He was a big part of the weight loss. We worked hard at me sort of losing it. He was checking. He's still got the pictures today of the weighing scales every week. And then, of course, I went to university. And it was Middlesex University where I had my first SMC coach, John Cree. And he was fantastic. We worked, and it wasn't a quick, you know, change. It was 2 years of hard work, and the weight just came off bit by bit, and I lost, I think then, about 32 kilos, and it was just hard work in the gym, you know, 3-4 times a week. The fencing, of course, had now upped, was back at the top level. I was training most days, plus the S&C, the strength and conditioning, and then trying to eat right, you know, trying to eat better. Once I was no longer a kid, you know, cut out the junk food, certainly all the sweet, sugary drinks was the killer. So now, you know, even today, the majority of the time, it's just water. And it was tough, but now I'm at my lightest ever. You know, I had an injury this year, which put me out fencing for a while, and I've lost another 10 kilos. I'm around 92 kilos. So I was around probably 8 to 10 kilos. That was working with Jeff Marshall, our strength and conditioning coach, British fencing. And this was, we set the goal when I came back from the injury to get down to 95, which was the lightest I'd ever been. And we smashed it. Within 3 weeks, we were down. We couldn't believe it. So we just wanted to keep maintaining it and see how well we could do. And we got down to about 91, 92. So I hit 90 once, which was just phenomenal. But I'm consistently 92 kilos right now, so best weight I've ever been.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I presume it was one hell of a mental battle to sort of go through all of that. Yeah,
it is. It's a tough battle. You know, some of the time you need someone there to support you. I must say that this has probably been the last 3 months has been the hardest period because, you know, I'm fit already, so trying to lose 10 kilos is tough. And you need those days where someone's going to push you, that day where you feel really, really tired. You know, your muscles are aching, you're struggling, and you still got to do the bike session after everything in the day.
Yeah, and that, I suppose that weight loss has ultimately ended up in your rise to the senior circuit, into those senior ranks. And then along comes London 2012, which I think was sort of the catalyst in the end for you making that eventual decision. Going along to London 2012, the Home Olympics, so it was certainly one of my favourite periods living in London because everything was just so happy and it was this glorious little bubble for 2 weeks.
And yeah,
as a fencer myself, I was lucky enough to go to the Sabre Finals and watch them. As a competitor and a Londoner, what was it like, and can you sum up being right at the centre of that manic 2 weeks?
It was crazy. I was living in East London at the time. With my teammate Hussein Rozowski, who also was in London with me. We were driving to Lee Valley every day, so I'd have to drive past the Olympic Village being built for 2 years prior. And at that time, we weren't even sort of in contention. You know, the team was kind of set with, you know, Richard Lawrence, Kemba, and Jeff Breeze. We were well outside. You know, I think we were just finishing off our juniors as well. And, you know, we just plodded along, get on with it, keep your head down and work hard. And you know, as time got nearer and nearer, I remember in 2011, I finished my junior career and starting senior season. And I was just getting result after result. You know, it wasn't medals, but it was consistent. It was consistent results. I think I made like 2 or 3 quarterfinals that year. So it was a great, it was a real great push for me. It was fantastic, you know. I was knocking out top 16 fencers in the world. Of course, I was ranked like 50-60th at the time, and it felt fantastic. You know, I realized halfway through, like, oh wow, I'm actually putting myself in contention for an Olympic spot here. Something that it was only ever a dream, and now this was suddenly it was real life. And I just kept mulling away at it, and then I got the phone call in the end saying I would be going. And once we were there, it was amazing. You know, it was still, Rio was fantastic, but you'll never beat a home Olympic Games. We went, of course, we had no other clothing but Olympic gear. I remember going out, we went to our house. We were still actually looking for a flat when we were in the Olympics. So once the Games was over, we were still having to go to estate agents to try and find somewhere to rent. And we were sorting out a place. So we were still in all our Olympic gear, and we were on the tube once, trying to be as sort of incognito as possible. And this little girl noticed my teammate's shoes and came running up to us and set the tube just alight. They were going mad. They wanted the badges. They wanted pictures. It was just unbelievable. But it was fantastic to see so many people just so happy and so proud. And to be part of that was just phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the impression I got when I was travelling in. Because I live in East London as well. I got the same sort of vibe. But I suppose it's almost that surreal experience as an athlete yourself when you get people coming up to that. It's almost that sort of celebrity status for a little bit.
Oh, it was, for sure. You know, people didn't know your name, but they knew you were a British Olympian. So it was good enough. And they were just happy. You know, it was nice to have this British sort of bubble. Wherever we were, they didn't care what sport, they weren't interested. It's just that we were representing the country, and that's what mattered most. And they were part of that, you know. And I think that was the thing. London Olympics was every person, every Londoner, every Briton was part of that. And that was the fun in it, you know. They could join in with us. And the fact that they got to see us so close and personal because we were out and about made it even more interesting for them, I think, and for us.
Now, sticking with London, but the city rather than the Games, if I say Barnet and home to you, what sort of memories does that conjure up for yourself?
Green, a little bit more hills, probably more school, actually. I was in school at Enfield, which is just the next borough, right on the outskirts, right on Barnet Barnet and Enfield borough. So we had a lot of Barnet kids going there to secondary school. So, you know, good childhood. I loved it. Nice area, you know.
Now, the reason I asked that is because, of course, in November 2013, you decided to up sticks and relocate to San Francisco.
Yeah.
Now, what was the meaning behind that? And how does life differ over there to over here in London?
Ooh, it's interesting. It's not, I think when I first came here, I had no idea what to expect. You know, I heard San Francisco and I knew Golden Gate Bridge, that was about it. And the rest of it, I just thought was going to be a major city. I had no idea how small it was, 7x7. And, you know, it's got two giant parks that take up most of the city. So I was really quite shocked. But very quickly, I fell in love with it. You know, I came up the first 2 months was a trial period to see if I'd like it or not. And it was so easy to fall in love with. It really was. The people were very friendly. I think one thing, coming from London, this is where during the Games was very different, you know. Growing up in London was realising no one talks to anybody there. You know, you don't talk, you go, everyone's got somewhere to be. They got to work. You know, so you read your paper, get on with it. Out here, everybody talks to everybody non-stop. So I found it really difficult the first few weeks. Everyone was so friendly, and I was struggling with it. It came across to me as false. And then with time, I realised this was not going away. This was just how they are. They are just genuinely very, very nice people. They do care. They are supportive. You know, a lot of the parents at the club would go out their way to help, you know, and that's just how they are, and I love it. You know? But ultimately, I think the thing is, both will always be home. You know, occasionally I still miss Barnet. I still miss going back home. London for me is still the best city in the world. You know, growing up, being in university there, you can't beat it.
And with regards to the coaching over there, what's different about it to over in Britain? And how much do you feel you've developed as an athlete and a fencer?
Well, I think so. The reason I came here was because of there was a lot of issues at the time. My coach, Jemak, at the time was no longer a national coach, which made things slightly difficult. Originally, he was going to come out with me here and train with me some of the time. Unfortunately, that fell apart with time because he's got his own commitments back in the UK. But basically, really, I wanted to keep pushing myself. You know, I wanted to be able to work how I felt was best for me. And I thought at the time, I just made the World Top 16. And I wanted to continue to push myself. I thought if I stayed in the UK, I could maintain that, but I wouldn't progress from that. And I wanted to just be the best. And the system is very, very different. It's very unorthodox what Greg has done. He's sort of amalgamated various different systems to produce his own system. But I think that the biggest thing is I'm happier. I'm freer. You know, I have full control over my program. Of course, over the past few years, I mean, I've been very fortunate in 3 years that the Federation were very supportive. They've done a great job with me out here. They didn't make my life difficult. So, you know, I do owe them a lot for letting me come and allowing me to have this opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems to have worked with yourself. I mean, talking about the results that you've been getting, and the main standout one is, of course, the European Championship in 2014 that you won, first Britain to do it. In Strasbourg. How important a moment was that? And that podium success, not just for you as an athlete, but also you as a man?
You know, the biggest thing going into that is that I wasn't thinking about trying to be European champion. And I think that was just a mental sort of process. I'd done a lot of work with the sports psych, but I still work with now, Katie Warriner. And she'd been fantastic. She was actually there with us. And the biggest thing was going into a major championship, but not treating it like anything other than another tournament. And, you know, ultimately, it's always there. You know, regardless of what you say, you always want to be champion. You always want to be national champion, European champion, world, Olympic champion. You know, that's what we work for. You know, we're not working to be second best. And ultimately, you know, I'm the first one to have done it for Britain in a very long time. At any major championship, and I'm the first ever Briton to win a European championship, and that meant a great deal for me. It was just being out on that stage. I was bronze medal in 2013, so going into this, I was like, okay, I've been on the semi final stage before. Let's just keep pushing. And you know, I had some great fences. I had the fence end up. Fencing and Peter Yopik, one of my favourite fencers, you know. But I had a great record with him, and I just fenced phenomenal. You know, it was under the lights. It was just very, very relaxed, very calm. I breezed through it. And then in the final, it was very different. Very nervous, and started off okay, and then fell behind massively. And I remember speaking with Jamak about it during the break and stuff, and just it wasn't going well. And then we ended up with my equipment, my jacket was starting to light up just before from the sweat, and he got a point because of that. So we had to change my jacket, and that little break, that little block, allowed me to go off, reassess, and I was on my own. You know, not allowed to talk to anybody in that period. You only allowed to change your equipment. You're being watched by the referee, but it just gave me a little time to realise, like, what are you doing? You know, You've come all this way, and you've lost. You know, you're throwing it away because you're scared. And I remember just coming back on, nothing to lose, it's done, get on with it. And it's just one after another. And I made sure that when you reach the same level as him, the same score, that it doesn't change. You don't suddenly revert back and start thinking, oh gosh, now I've got something to lose. You just keep going. And it just went one after another, and he became shell-shocked. He was stuck. Frozen, and I became European champion. And you know, it people already knew I was a good fencer. You know, the guys on the circuit knew me. But once you got a major championship under your belt, you know, you're taken seriously all the time. You know, people start talking about you at major championships, so the potential to do it again. So it's definitely, for me, it was fantastic. I loved it, and you know, I like the pressure. I like to rise to the pressure. And yeah, you know, we'll see what can happen in the future. Maybe I can replicate that again. That's definitely the dream.
I'm sure it is. Sure. Now, fast forwarding to the most recent Olympics in Rio. So you went out in the last 16 to the eventual bronze medalist, Timur Safin of Russia. Hope I'm saying that right. But it was a really narrow defeat, 15-13. How do you evaluate your own individual performance at Rio?
disappointed. Definitely disappointed. Spence won the first round, and I was destroying him. I had a great lead on him. And I mean, two things. He's well known for making these comebacks. He does it pretty much every bout. Loses the lead and makes the comeback. At the same time, knowing that I should have been able to deal with it. You know, I'd beaten him before. He'd beaten me that season. So we'd met twice already. But I was, you know, it was devastating the way he came back, and I just couldn't change. And that's pressure, you know. Ultimately, on the big stage, I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't change, and I couldn't adapt to what he was doing. And all I needed to do was to sort of take a break and reassess. Very similar to what I did at the Euros, but under the big lights, and I in a way, I froze and just did the same action over and over. That was definitely a mistake. I'll look back at it and realise I messed up there. But I learned very quickly. I learned the day after we just had a relaxation. You know, we didn't talk about anything. And then we had to prepare for the team event. So I had to watch the bout back in preparation for the Russians. And I made sure that I came out of there that I was going to beat every single one of them. And that's exactly what I did. You know, I destroyed them. I had a massive indicator. I was plus on all of them, including Safin. But ultimately we lost by 2 points, which frankly, you know, we shouldn't have. We fenced that we were the better team, and you know, everyone that saw the bout knows we were the better team, but that's unfortunate how it goes. I would say the team event, both myself and the team, we were great. We were fantastic. You know, we deserve to be fighting for a medal at least. But that's sport, you know, and you just have to sometimes just get one light and don't let anyone else ruin it for you, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the fine margins of sport that it always comes down to. I was going to mention the team, which is yourself, Richard Cruz, Marcus Mepstead, and Lawrence Halstead.
That's it.
45-43, that match against Russia, and finishing sixth. I know everyone was disappointed with that overall result after the loss to China as well. But that team has come on so much. Now that we're talking about it, to be in medal contention, how happy does that make you?
Yeah, I'm not so happy that, you know, we're talking about being in medal contention. I'd much rather be talking about us being medalists. You know, we beat the French in the Euros. You know, we were confident. Had that been our draw, we could have won. So, you know, it'll always be bittersweet. But I know how much work was put into that team and how hard we worked for 2 years straight. We worked our socks off every day. We were doing, you know, sports psych work together as a group. We did our homework with the coach. We went over it. We gelled, you know. There's a big age difference between, you know, Marcus and myself 1 year, and then the other guys, there's like 8 years between us. So, but we've known each other for many years, so it was working together. And, you know, over 2 years, we look back, and Lawrence wrote a good piece in the Sword, the fencing magazine, just about it. And you realize that there was so much luck that was also required to get there. You know, we had lots of luck as well. But we also had lots of issues along the way, lots of difficult times where we were the better team and we lost. And ultimately, that's, of course, what happened in the Olympics. But it just showed, you know, we worked really hard, and I was really proud to be a member of that team with those guys. I thoroughly enjoyed working with them, and the most fun I've ever had. I don't think it'll ever be as enjoyable. You know, the guys were all, we were all professional. We really worked. We had one goal in mind, and we went out there and we gave our best. And you know, I'll always be proud of that. I'll always be proud of working with those three guys. You know, it's probably the best team I think Britain will have for a very, very long time.
Now, this may be putting you on the spot slightly, but having lost to a Russian in the individual competition and then losing out to the Russian team. So with the Russian doping scandal in the lead-up to Rio, and obviously everyone was calling for that big sort of exodus of the Russian team, but eventually the IOC decided to leave it up to the individual sports. What did you think of that decision and or the criticism of it? And should the Russian team have been there at all?
I mean, it's a great question. As a competitor still, I'm not going to sort of bow my hand too much. What I would say is, you know, our sport is a very small sport. That doesn't mean that doping isn't taking place, that there aren't going to be cheats within the sport. I would like to think that of the fencers that I know, the Russians that are in the team, that, you know, they're honest, or they're at least going to abide by the rules. You know, you can never be sure. As far as I'm aware, those guys are professional. They've always passed the tests. So it's one of those, is it fair that they lose out because of, you know, other sports, you know, like in athletics, that have doped? You know, they're a solid team. They're a big part of fencing. You know, in fencing, Russia's a major force. So, you know, if you flip it on its head, it's not necessarily fair that clean athletes are missing out. I know certainly if Britain was in that position and not being a drugs cheat, I would be very upset. So, you know, it's a hard one to say. But as far as we're aware, none of those guys have ever failed a test, so there's no reason for them not to be allowed to compete. And ultimately, you just have to deal with whoever's in front of you, and that's what we got to make the most of, and, you know, hope that the authorities are doing the right thing, and those people will be brought to light and brought to justice for it.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly an angle that a lot of people took when it was, you know, it was being discussed and the decision was ongoing. Now, going on to sort of the ongoing problem in British fencing at the moment, and that's, of course, UK Sport's decision to cut the funding for the world-class programme, which is essentially the Olympic pathway for fencing. Now, it's fresh in my mind because I obviously did an article very recently, and when I spoke to Georgina Usher, British fencing CEO, she said how shocked and surprised she was by the decision that came completely out of the blue. Did you have a similar reaction to the news?
Yeah, I did, because my funding was being reduced because, of course, we hadn't medalled at the Olympics. So we were under the impression that that was, you know, okay, fine. You know, I wasn't particularly happy, but, you know, it's performance sport at the end of the day. So I understood that it was going to make my life harder to get by, certainly living in America. You know, my costs are much higher. But I accepted that. So I was back in the UK because of injury. I had to have surgery. So I was at the training centre, the Liverpool training centre, with the guys, and we just got called into the room for a meeting. So, you know, up we went, and then they broke the news to us. It was very, very surprising, you know. They were definitely caught them by surprise, and of course the athletes, we had no idea. You know, we knew the date was coming, but it was more of a formality is how it was being sort of told to us. No one was nervous about the day or anything. It was just going to go along. If anything, maybe funding would be reduced a bit, potentially. That even wasn't necessarily the case. But then when we were told it was just cut, you know, I wasn't sort of gasping for air. I was fine, you know. I've been in this position before where I was cut off funding as a junior. So it for me, I was like, okay, I want to get on with it, just get out of it and get back on my training. It doesn't change much for me in that I knew I want to continue to fence. I didn't come into this sport to make money, because I tell you now, the money that we were being given, you know, it allowed us to get by. I think some people think we live a life of luxury anyway, but we really don't. You know, none of the athletes are making any money from their sport. It allows them to pay for the bare minimum, pay for their flights, pay for their food, their accommodation. But, you know, you're not rich from sport. So, for me, it wasn't changing that. I was going to continue to fence, and I just now had to find a way to fund that myself. And that's the difficult side of it. For some of the guys, they were in the sport because they decided they were going to maybe put their university on hold, or they were going to give it a little try while they stay, you know, stay at home or something like that, you know, out of a little passion. So for them, it was more difficult for some of the younger guys or some of the Sabre lot who had made the commitment for a couple of years and put things on hold, put their careers on hold. So I feel sorry for them quite a bit as well, to be honest, because it's tough on them. It's tough on me, but at least I know where I want to be. I know that fencing's my passion, that regardless of whether we're funded or not, I was continuing.
But I wanted to ask, the UK sport policy, they decided to withdraw the funding for fencing because fencing could possibly win a medal, but others would probably win a medal. What do you think of that policy as a whole? And does it maybe prevent smaller sports such as fencing growing?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, sport is about winning at the end of the day, you know, and that's what we want. We're not here to support losers, ultimately. You know, they are putting a lot of money into sport and they want winners, and, you know, I totally get that. The issue I have with it is, I think, this idea of what it takes to be a winner, you know, and in small sports especially, it requires a lot of support. And it's not throw money at something and hope for the best. And unfortunately, I think maybe that's where it's gone wrong over time. I feel there's a lot of small sports out there that aren't getting the right kind of support, and we were certainly one of them. You know, we didn't need maybe some of the money that was given. It just needed to be spent better, perhaps. And, you know, the issue is, by pulling it, they've sort of thrown us back 10 years, whereas reducing it would have maybe been better. They could have assessed how the money was being spent. But fencing is a sport that, because of the funding, because of the UK sport funding, it became totally reliant on that money. There's no other income coming in, really. So that really, that's effectively killed the sport, and it's going to take a lot of hard work from British fencing. They're going to have to be very innovative to find ways to keep this sport going, certainly at the top level. And ultimately, we've got Sport England money coming in, which has been thankful for that, but that's for grassroots and the youth coming through. But there's no point if there's not an elite program. If there's nowhere for them to go at the top level, you're producing kids to effectively quit once they're out of their teens and go on into the working world. So the elite level sport is never going to be there. So unfortunately, I feel it's just going to get carried by the last remaining few of us and one or two that come through over the years. But that's not where we wanted to be. I think the hardest thing for these small sports will always be the amount of money that is being pumped into those big major sports. And I'll always struggle to understand if it really is about medals or if it's about publicity, about the sports that basically have the biggest image rights, you know, the ones that are on TV. Because ultimately, you know, I've grown up seeing many, many athletes in other sports that are never going to go to an Olympic Games, you know, never forget medaling. They're not second tier to qualify, but they'll be funded athletes. And that's hard for a small sport sometimes to see and deal with. But there's huge sums of money going into these major sports that can also get private sponsorship very, very easily, whereas a small sport, we do struggle.
They've got the hashtag Fun Fencing crowdfunding appeal going on at the moment. There's obviously still a lot to be decided for British fencing on how to go forwards. But sponsorship has been muted, and you just mentioned it there. Is that something you think is probably needed to go forward?
Oh, 100%. 100%. If we're to go anywhere near where we were before, and we were going the right way, you know, I can only speak of men's foil, but we were solid. You know, we've had great support. You know, the likes of Jemac has produced pretty much every top fencer in the UK. So there still needs to be some idea to produce more youth, British coaches coming through, so that we can have more than just Jemac doing that. But you do need money, you do need sponsorship, you need support to get us back to the level we were at. For me, myself, it's so hard to fund from San Francisco, flying from here. But I'm here for one reason, for my fencing. I'm here because this was the best club to come to. You know, and I had to leave everything behind so that I can do this. But to be able to continue this, to stay at the top level in the sport, it requires support. And I hope that there's people out there listening that are willing to help us on our path.
Absolutely. So putting that away for one moment, and then looking ahead to this current season, what are you hoping to achieve and get out of the season?
So for me, this season, I must say, is very different to most. I spoke a bit about the injury before. I was training midway. I missed the first couple of tournaments. I was ranked sixth in the world. So I've been top 16 for the past 4 years now. That's because, of course, I missed 3 months. My collarbone was separated, so I had to fly back to the UK and have surgery. So I've been out for... I missed the first five or six tournaments of the season. So that's why my ranking's just been dropping. So I did the first tournament in Long Beach, which was about 3 weeks ago. Of course, I just made it through, scraped through the pools, first time back in the group stages. And I lost to Safin again, 15-14 this time. But it was great. It was, for me, it was fantastic to be out there. You know, I wasn't upset or anything. It was an opportunity to see where I am right now, what I need to work on. Fitness was good. You know, like I said, I'm in good shape, but you know, I don't have that competition sort of readiness. Being back in the pools is something slightly different for me. I haven't done that in 3 years. So, you know, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying being back on the circuit. I'm enjoying, you know, my arm is getting back to full strength. The injury is behind me now. You know, still doing all the rehab and stuff, but you know, I'm out of the danger zone as such. So, the rest of the season, you know, I've got two tournaments coming, and then the European Championships and World Championships. And I'm not pressuring myself. I just want to enjoy it. It's nice being back with my teammates, back on the circuit, and I'm just going to take it one tournament at a time. You know, there's no big rush. There's no major desire. I just want to see where I'm at and then look for the new season to come in hard and strong. So ultimately, going into World Champs is the big deal for sure. That's at the end of the season in July. And I want to put myself in a great position going into that, that at least I'll be ready and able to compete to my best.
Yeah, and then hopefully onwards and upwards from there on.
Yeah, you know, it's still a long way away, 3 years to go then until the next Olympic Games, and it'll be a year and a half until the Olympic cycle actually begins. So I'm aware of all the issues that's going to take place, you know, but by then I hope that I won't have the issue of funding. I really hope by then that there will be some support, no matter how small, anything will help.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, James. And issues aside, I really hope you get all the success and really wish you the very best when you go for whatever targets it is you're going for. It's certainly been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm sure all the listeners would agree as well. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview with James. We'll just point you in the direction of some of the sporting events that are upcoming before we go. The London Marathon is on Sunday. WSL1 Spring Series also starts this weekend. Myself and Will, we're going to the hockey finals in Stratford, and the FA Cup semi-finals are also this weekend. Now, of course, you can like us on Facebook. Our Facebook page is SportsBuildPod. Follow us on Instagram. That's also SportsBuildPod. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Surprise, surprise, it's at SportsBuildPod. You can also go onto our website, sportsbuildonline.com, or get in touch with us to give us feedback or just general criticism. We don't really mind. Email us at sportsbuildpod@gmail.com. We'll hopefully be on iTunes soon, but for now, it's goodbye from the pair of us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.